and welcome to Sitfor Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. Since our last episode, there have been some monumental changes in the UK. We were deeply saddened to hear of the passing of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, and on today's episode, we're joined by Sitfor CEO Rob Whiteman, who gives his reaction and thoughts on this very sad event. We are also joined by Ian Taylor, who is a research and policy associate at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. He discusses his report on the business of levelling up. Lastly, we're joined by Sitfor's Associate Director Andrew Burns, Sitfor Local Government Policy Manager Joanne Pitt, Sitfor's Chief Economist Jeffrey Matsu, and Sitfor's Health and Social Care Policy Manager Eleanor Roy, who all give their thoughts on the government's recently announced mini-budget. Up first, we'll hear from Rob Whiteman.
I'm delighted to be joined by Rob Whiteman, Sitfor CEO. Hi, Rob, and thanks for joining us on this edition of Sitfor Speaks.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you, Mark.
Well, it's been a monumental couple of weeks, to say the least. We've had a new Prime Minister, the death of the Queen, a mini budget, economic chaos, and now a major U-turn by the Chancellor. To use his words, this is certainly a new era. Firstly, the Queen was, of course, a devoted public servant up until the very end. Her sense of duty characterised her entire reign, perhaps epitomised by her carrying out her duty to oversee the change of Prime Minister during her final days. Can you give us your thoughts on the Queen leading a life devoted to public service? And what can we learn from the example she set in terms of what it means to be a public servant?
I'm full of admiration for the late Queen, as of course we all are. I think to answer your question, there's an interesting lesson that you have to do the job in the way that the job expects to be done rather than the way you might want to do it. And what I mean from that, Mark, is our constitutional monarch has to be above politics in order that the armed forces and the judiciary and everybody swears allegiance to a head of state that isn't a politician. And then we, the public, can elect and throw out our politicians at will because we have a non-political constitutional head. And in a 70-year reign, the longest reign in British history, you can count the number of controversies on one hand, and many of them actually were not of the Queen's making. I mean, the prorogation of Parliament, the Queen acted on advice from her Prime Minister. Way back in the 1960s, the Queen acted on the advice of Harold Macmillan to call Alec Douglas Hume rather than Rad Butler, which created quite a controversy at the time. But she acted on the advice of her outgoing Prime Minister. And there are just a couple of times in a 70-year reign, perhaps the fallout with Margaret Thatcher over the Commonwealth, or perhaps the initial reaction to the death of Princess Diana, where the public was not in tune with the Queen, or the Queen was acting maybe perhaps slightly outside her constitutional boundaries. That is a remarkable achievement. And the lesson for us is sometimes you have to do the job properly, which might not be the way you want to do it. But if you're in the chair of a position of leadership, you have to do the job that's expected of you. And I think that's a great lesson to many public sector leaders about making difficult decisions and doing what's expected of you rather than what you might want to do.
Thanks, Rob. And now on to the other major news of recent weeks. In the government's fiscal event, the Chancellor unveiled the biggest tax cuts in a generation, the freezing of corporation tax and the removal of the higher rate of tax, which the government have now performed a U-turn on, along with government's unfunded plans to borrow more for day-to-day spending, caused panic in the financial markets, with the pound plummeting and the Bank of England taking the unprecedented step of intervening. Has the government thrown good public financial management and fiscal discipline out the window?
For the time being, I'm afraid it has, and we must hope that that discipline is restored very quickly. Growth is a laudable aim. Economic growth is the secret to paying off the debt amassed following the financial crisis and COVID, and now the energy crisis, which has needed government funding. We need economic growth. However, there's no quick fix. And the successful levers to pull in the economy are about supply side reforms. How do we have the skills in our workforce that we need? How are people able to get to work through transport? How do we have good public health in order that we have a fit and able workforce? There's a whole range of things that the government can help to ensure that businesses and public services can get the high-skilled workforce that's needed. There's no quick fix to this, and the idea that suddenly giving some quick tax cuts and throwing financial prudence out the window will lead to economic growth rather than those supply side factors that I've just spoken about is pie in the sky. And I'm afraid that for the time being, the fiscal position of the government has been made much worse. And actually, my worry is that that will use up a lot of their bandwidth and they won't have the ability to deal with things that government should and can deal with. And as we'll doubtless come on to, my God, it creates a problem now for public services to balance the books.
So you mentioned public services there, Rob, in your answer. We now know that there will be no autumn budget with public spending frozen in line with the 2021 spending review. And we are now hearing that government departments may be asked to find efficiency savings. While the 2021 spending review was relatively generous, with an average increase of around 3.4% in budgets across sectors, soaring inflation and higher than expected pay awards have all but wiped out these gains. As it stands right now, public bodies simply do not have the funds to get them back to pre-pandemic performance levels, with backlogs, delays and staff shortages still plaguing them. Should local authorities now be planning for the worst? Should we be preparing for the return of austerity in all but name?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes, I'm afraid. So the gap that they're going to try and find through departmental savings is as big as the savings that Chancellor George Osborne made that were labelled austerity at the time. And I don't think public services are nearly as able to find savings now as they were back then. So I'm afraid it is fear the worst. Now, I think there are two things to say. Clearly, the sector needs to lobby hard around the considerable cost and demand pressures that it has. Local government is facing very high inflation on many of its costs, and also many demand pressures are going up because of the position of the economy, and we appear to be heading for recession. And actually, the demand for services will go up at the same time that their costs are going up. So local government has to lobby hard. And I think that means we need our political leadership in local government to lobby on a combined basis, on a cross-party basis, in order to point out just how difficult it is for councils. And of course, officer groups like CITFA and Solace and other groups have got to lobby very hard. However, we know, I'm afraid, from history, that whilst I believe that lobbying is justified, we know that local government tends to be singled out during a period of austerity. And in a way that the local government sector lost out quite a lot during the Osborne years and got higher cuts than other parts of the state, I'm afraid that's likely now. I think the government is going to make a lot of very poor short-term decisions because it's in a bit of a crisis. There isn't a long-term plan for balancing the books. The spending review has been deferred. I'm afraid all of this adds up to some bad decisions and the sector's going to pay the price for it. So I do think the sector should fear the worst. I think there's also a risk, particularly, obviously, you know, there's some politics in this. Looking at the opinion polls, it would be very easy probably for some Labour authorities to think, well, my word, we're not going to get any money out of the Conservative government, but we're going to have a Labour government soon and they'll put our budgets right. So maybe we can just hang on and not do what's needed. And I don't think that will work, I'm afraid. I think the pressures are so great. And similarly, there will be Conservative authorities out there that will think, well, I'm in a marginal seat and the government's going to help me as much as possible before the next election. So maybe we don't have to make difficult decisions. And so I think the management of politics within authorities for finance directors and chief executives and executive teams is going to be really tough, because as we get nearer to a general election, councils are going to perhaps feel that they can avoid some difficult decisions. And I don't say that with any pleasure at all. I think the sector's going to have to make very difficult decisions, fear the worst. And my advice is to get on and do it, even though it's unattractive, because the more that you can stay ahead of the curve and in control of your budget, the better. If you defer those decisions, hoping that the government of the day or a future government will help you out a bit, my word, you're running a risk of losing control of your budget.
The fiscal event was, of course, delivered without the traditional independent assurance and analysis by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Can you tell our listeners why having this independent assurance is so important when spending public money?
Institutions create confidence, and what we most want is that the government can borrow its money more cheaply than other governments, and it can issue bonds and people will take those bonds with less interest attached than it will take the bonds of other countries. And this is around confidence in the institutions that Parliament has created around government. The independence of the Bank of England is important, and the rhythm and regularity of our fiscal events is important, which includes that fiscal events are scored by the Independent Office of Budget Responsibility, so that when the Chancellor makes statements about the effect of those proposals, they are fully understood at the point of making policy. And to undermine those institutions is really very dangerous. And so the markets took fright, not probably on any one individual transaction. Actually, the markets, I think, have taken fright because they're not as certain that the UK cherishes and will uphold the institutions on which it can have confidence that the government will act in the right way. And I think restoring that confidence in our institutions will now take a while to happen, but is incredibly important. And I think we've got into a little bit of a trap where the government feels we don't like these independent institutions. They are affecting our ability as the government or Parliament's ability to do what it wants. And I say to that, yes, that's the very idea of it. Parliament has created these institutions in order that the public and the markets can have confidence. And if you undermine those institutions in order that you can feel you're in a bit more control, actually, that creates a considerable risk that you will act badly and not make good decision making. And I think we've got into the politics of institutions not being respected, where in the past, Parliament and governments deliberately curtailed their short-term powers a little bit by creating independent institutions because they knew it would lead to better government. And where the UK has always prided itself on massively strong institutions, and that appears to be being undermined at the moment, and that will be at the nation's peril.
Finally, the government have clearly prioritised short-term flexibility in public spending. Why is now not the right time to do this? And in your view, will the government need to reconsider more of the tax cuts they've promised? And if so, which ones should they be?
Well, I tweeted on the day that I thought the 45p cut in higher rate income tax would never happen, because actually Parliament would never vote for it. It was absolutely clear that Red Wall seats, for example, would never vote for it. So, I mean, that one was clearly not going to happen. I think the other changes that have been announced will happen. I can't see the government easily now pulling out of the changes on national insurance or the 1p rate. I think they will stick. What we have to do is create a more financially literate debate about tax. I keep hearing, and I'm really fed up with hearing it, Mark, so I'm sorry if there's a bit of crossness in my voice for you and our listeners. I keep hearing that tax is at a 70-year high, and that's why it has to be brought down. But I think I would really ask politicians to also point out that Britain is not a high tax economy, and that we're in the middle between sort of high taxes that you can have in some advanced European economies and the lower tax that you can get in some economies such as the US. Although the US is often used as an example of a lower tax economy, but actually remember how much devolution there is in the US, where different layers of state and federal government levy taxes, which isn't pulled together in the way that the UK pulls everything together through the whole of government accounts. But the point I'm making is we are not a high tax economy. And so it's disingenuous to say we're paying more taxes than we have done in 70 years. We spend less on public services than many other economies as a proportion of our GDP. And of course, uniquely, because the NHS is paid for at the point of use out of taxation in a way that it isn't in some other economies, it means that to some extent, non-NHS services can get crowded out because the NHS is so very important to our lives. So I really, really, really think that we have to push back and point out that we are not a high tax economy, even if taxes are relatively high compared to the last 50, 60 or 70 years. We are not a high tax economy. And to suggest that there's more fat in local government, public services can be cut, that the solution to the fiscal problems of the government is some sort of efficiency drive, is financially illiterate. And actually, there is always space for efficiency. There is always space to save more money. But I'm afraid what we also need is space for sensible and coherent government to have a proper debate about the level of taxation in an advanced economy where actually we are not a high tax nation. And if we're going to stick with the public services that the public expect and demand, then actually the government is going to have to come clean with the public. And we appear to be that we've reduced ourselves at the moment to being in campaign mode rather than governing. And going back to the first comment of the way this podcast started about my respect for the late Queen doing the job that needed to be done, I have a huge amount of respect for politicians, and I've been very lucky to work in both local government and central government for many brilliant politicians who are a credit to public life. But what I've seen from our very best politicians, the very best politicians I've worked for, is that they make difficult decisions that are against their instincts, but they know they're in the chair and that they have to make the decision that's right for the country or their local area, not the decision that simply falls in with their own particular ideology or belief. And at the moment, I'm afraid, we have a government which is in campaign mode rather than in governing mode. And it may be attractive to say that there's fat in local services and efficiencies can be made, but I can promise you what we actually need is a proper debate about the level of taxation.
Great. Thanks, Rob, for joining us today on this edition of SIPFA Speaks.
That was SIPFA CEO Rob Whiteman discussing the sad passing of the late Queen Elizabeth II and some of the recent changes in government. Up next, we'll hear from Ian Taylor, who is a research and policy associate at the University of Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government. He discusses his report on the business of levelling up. And thank you so much for joining me today on SIPFA Speaks. Could you please introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about your career history?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for inviting me. So my name is Ian Taylor, and I work at the University of Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government. I work in research there. I work mainly in the areas of place-based approaches, cross-sector collaboration and responsible business. Before joining the University of Oxford, I worked for a decade in the energy industry in a variety of commercial management and research management roles. And I returned to academic study, focusing on political science, and joined the Government Outcomes Lab here at Oxford to help them work on how government can deliver improved social outcomes. It's a really exciting place to work.
So we are here to talk about the report that you were the author of called Partnerships in Place, the Business of Levelling Up. Could you tell us how that report came about and some of the findings from it?
Yeah, sure. The charity Business in the Community, they saw there was potential for businesses to contribute more to place-based regeneration. So they convened a task force of senior representatives from different sectors. It was chaired by Lord Steve Bassam. So he's a peer who had previously chaired a Lords Select Committee inquiry into left behind coastal communities. So he had some great experience in how to run one of these. So we gathered the task force together. It was a task force that had representatives from big business, so such as KPMG, PwC, the law firm Freshfields, Brockhaus Derringer, Barclays. We had charities on that, such as the Barrow Cadbury Trust and Power to Change. Universities, so there's the Lancaster University. We had the incoming General Secretary of the TUC represented the Trades Union Congress. And we had government representatives like the Local Government Association, with the, you know, councillors like the leader of Stoke-on-Trent Council and the former head of the UK Civil Service, Lord Bob Kerslake. So it's a really good collection of individuals to help steer this inquiry that we conducted. So the aim of the task force was to determine how society can harness the energy of business for place-based transformational change. So I led the research and we conducted a broad inquiry. We took evidence in various forms, including verbal evidence sessions on specific themes from over 70 organizations. And the insights that gathered are really valuable, and I'm really grateful for those who took part and contributed evidence. So the report Partnerships in Place is all about place-based approaches to improving social outcomes, and voluntary cross-sector partnerships featured very prominently in that. So we had many findings in this, what turned out to be a 100-page report that was published in May this year. The report split into three different sections. The first section is kind of, we called it, we had a working title of a situation report, SITREP, and it takes a broad view of the country and what's been done in place-based approaches and how the environment can be improved. And then the second part of the report is looking at actors that have engaged in place-based partnerships at the local level and what best practice we can gather from that. And then the third part looked at the different roles and parts and how different sectors can play to their strengths in these partnerships. So one of the, in terms of findings, that probably the most important finding was the fact that action was needed at all. So we asked cross-sector organizations to rank out of 10 how conducive the environment was to businesses contributing to regeneration efforts. The overall average answer for that was 5.9 out of 10, which is disappointing in its on itself, and so needs work. But really interesting was that the lowest score of only 2 out of 10 was from businesses, and really big businesses as well, with billions of pounds of turnover, over £1 billion of turnover each. And they ranked it only as 2 out of 10. And they also cited in their reasoning for this, when they defined environment to mean both internally to their organization and externally to the environment of the UK as a whole. And so that identified that there was really a need to do what we were engaged in at that point, which was identifying action that can be taken internally within organizations and from central government and local government and other actors in places. But the report contains recommendations for governments and also many recommendations for those local actors. And amongst the findings, we look at how the selection of place can be an issue, and how organizations with few physical assets can choose where to locate and what thematic areas businesses are conducive to get involved in. And we also found what factors influence organized businesses getting involved in these place-based partnerships. And so there's lots of really good findings, and I'd encourage anyone engaging with the report to look beyond just the headline recommendations and look at the analysis that sits beneath those findings, because there's loads of valuable observations that we gathered in that.
So the report focuses on the business of levelling up and the role that businesses can play in levelling up. So why did you choose to focus on that aspect of it, and what do you think businesses can do to support it?
Yeah, well, businesses are obviously a really powerful actor in society. They control lots of resources. They're a way of us as a society realizing efficiency and outcomes that we want to see. I mean, in terms of the number of people that are engaged, employed by private businesses, it's the overwhelming majority of the population. And so businesses are really useful as actors, but they also want to get involved. They've been articulating for years in really what's a bit of a new epoch for social responsibility, how much they want to get involved in having a purpose and serving society and communities. And I'm thinking of things like the 2019 US Business Roundtable statement, where they said that businesses are not just about serving shareholders anymore, they're about serving a wider stakeholders and actually serving a purpose. And the businesses that we spoke to themselves are representative of these kind of big resources and a desire to affect change. So the businesses we spoke to represent over 100 billion in turnover in 2021. So just the insights we gathered from those organizations was useful to understand, but also as an expression of that, just their participation in the inquiry was an expression of their desire to engage in social change. So yeah, businesses are useful and they want to help change. So we should, as a society, find ways to make that happen.
So the report also recommends that local government needs to take a leading role in setting the strategy at a place level. So what can local government do to support the levelling up agenda?
Yeah, local governments are really important. They can bring convening power for these local partnerships, cross-sector organisations. So they can bring them together and offer the democratic legitimacy that's really required when businesses are getting involved like this. And they can help draw action plans and articulate visions for the community to direct the energy and resources that are going in to affect this transformational change. So that's really important. When we asked cross-sector evidence contributors what leadership roles different sectors should take, local government was identified in lots of the areas, including setting strategy, which correlate with democratic legitimacy. And it shows how important local government is to take a lead in that. And that's mirrored in the local government's Levelling Up white paper. It argues that private and third sector collaboration with government at the local level is essential, but it goes on to argue that it's lacking because there are shortcomings from local government in taking that lead. They identify capacity and the ability to make powerful decision making. And so in the report, we offer guidance to help other actors and local government to navigate this decision making, this local collaboration. But we also make recommendations for ways in which central government can help empower local government with that capacity to take that leadership role. And it's something that the Levelling Up department's already engaging with, and we hope to see more from them.
I mean, it sounds like a fantastic resource then for local and central government. And so what are some of the barriers to businesses becoming engaged with the Levelling Up agenda, and how can those barriers be overcome?
Yeah, there are quite a lot. You know, we detail them in the report, as I say, 100 pages, so there's a lot of content in there. To take a couple that I think are probably important, the number one is probably the most obvious, which is selection of a place to get engaged with, because this is all about a place-based approach. So you're choosing a geographically defined area or areas that you want to have an impact in. And so that from a business point of view, I mean, I used to work in business and I think about it myself. When you're not an organization, a business that is anchored in a location with assets, physical assets especially, how do you go about choosing a place? And so we looked at the factors that affect that decision from businesses, but then we also present tools and give guidance on how these businesses can make that choice. So we discuss various frameworks for this identification, including well-known indices. Probably the most well-known one is the Index of Multiple Deprivation. But we examined 8 different indices where we offer a description and then advantages and disadvantages of each one of those. So they're presented to help readers to engage with those indices and use them in selection of places. But we did a rather more detailed analysis on one of the indices, which is the Social Fabric Index, which is a relatively new composite index, which is created. And that's really advantageous because it covers the whole of the UK, unlike most of these indices. And so the places in Scotland are comparable with places in Wales and England and Northern Ireland. And it's quite comprehensive. It has 79 statistical indicators over 5 themes. So it covers physical infrastructure, relationships, positive norms, economic values, and civic institutions. So you can drill down into the different aspects. And so businesses can have a think about what it is they want to do, how they might best impact these different thematic areas, and then they can do their selection based on that. And 50 of these statistical indicators are open source as well, which is really useful because it means that businesses can then get access to these 50 open source indicators and identify individual ones that they think are important. So that's a barrier that can be overcome, that selection through identification place through these tools. A second one is about engaging in collaboration itself. Consistent response we got when we asked these cross-sector organizations about what do they need to improve their collaboration at a place-based level. They said they wanted collaboration frameworks. And in many cases, they said they weren't even aware of any collaboration frameworks. So the report itself, the whole of the report, essentially, it offers guidance. So in a way, kind of acts as a collaboration framework. But within the report, it also identifies a specific collaboration framework, which has 19 questions that are reflective questions that a place-based partnership can ask themselves about the collaboration that they're setting up to make sure that it covers the areas of scope of the collaboration and the intensity of that collaboration and the degree to which consensus emerges and will emerge from that collaboration. So those are two of the key barriers that we offer ways to overcome in the report findings.
Did you find any particular examples of work carried out by businesses and local government to support Levelling Up that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, throughout the report, it's peppered with examples of evidence that we took. So we took qualitative and quantitative evidence, and those illustrative examples are all over the report in every section, and they're really useful for getting a real illustration of what was happening. But if I ever think of one example that I think was really informative and really an exemplar for what should be done, it's the actions of Anglian Water, the water utility company in a town called Wisbeach. So Wisbeach is in Cambridgeshire, and it's fairly close to Cambridge, and so you would kind of assume that it's quite prosperous, but it's actually quite disadvantaged in different ways. And it's geographically isolated as well. And Anglian Water selected that place. They went in and they decided that they wanted to try and help with positive transformation. And so they paid one of their project managers full time to go in and work in a role that we identified in the report as a connector. So he's basically like a network manager, went in, built trust with the different actors and stakeholders in the community, and identified opportunities for the different parties to assist each other. And they drew up a formalization of this partnership through governance systems. So they set up a framework, an action plan, a vision, and it was really quite transformative. And a couple of the tangible things that the connector, Russell Beale in Wisbeach, managed to do is they engaged a school that was underperforming quite significantly, and they managed to turn that around over a number of years of engagement with helping them in various different ways and innovative ways as well. And they also engaged with actors like a local charity. There's a homelessness charity, and they helped that charity secure a community centre and help them turn that into a really active hub for the community that's delivering loads of local services. That was the connector role. And we identified three different roles in the report: connector, champion, and ambassador. And they also provided a champion as well. So their CEO got in there and really got engaged in the problems of the place and helped with the communication, and crucially with advocacy, because he had a lot of high social capital, good network, and obviously commanded resources as well, and was able to pick up the phone, make calls, and use that networking connections that they had as an organization to help that town secure important things such as help with transport connectivity. So that is an example, I think, is a really good one, and it's talked about quite a bit in the report.
Great, thank you. And if anybody wants to access the report or find out more about it, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, well, the report itself is published on the Business in the Community website. So Business in the Community, the charity that work with lots of corporate businesses and try and help them do good and serve a useful social purpose. So they published it on their website, but it's also published on the website of the Barrow Cadbury Trust as well. And it's really quite simple. If you just do a search for Place Task Force Report on Google, it should come up, one of the top results. But of course, yeah, if you use the full title on Google, it will come up and you get free access to it. But yeah, I do quite a lot of sessions where I go around talking about the report and trying to help people engage with it, because it's a bit intimidating at 100 pages. And I do find that there's a tendency as well to read the 14 recommendations at the top of the report, which are really calls to action. But the real value, I think, is the meat of the report. And even if you just open it up and have a look at the contents page and look at the different sections that are relevant to your work, I think you'll find it very, very valuable.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us a bit more about that report.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks, Harriet. And I look forward to talking about the report more with anyone who's interested.
That was Ian Taylor from the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. Next up, we'll be joined by Andrew Burns, Joanne Pitt, Jeffrey Matsu and Eleanor Roy, who all give their thoughts on the government's recently announced mini-budget.
The mini-budget brought about the biggest tax cuts in a generation in order to drive growth and ward off recession, but they came without any independent analysis or planning for how this drop in tax take will be replaced. What are your thoughts on this unconventional approach, which has seemingly thrown fiscal discipline and good public financial management out the window?
The new government's approach to policymaking certainly introduces a lot of uncertainty. And when you couple today's uncertainty with the Chancellor's fiscal announcements, with two rounds of rather traumatic shocks that the UK economy was already reeling from, namely the pandemic and cost of living crisis, then I think that type of approach to shooting from the hip and not consulting with anyone or seeking the opinion of a third party like the Office for Budget Responsibility was probably not the best of moves for the government. And it really harms its credibility, both within its party, but also more broadly to society. So I think it really has challenged that the principles of transparency and accountability, which lie at the heart of good public financial management. And going forward, in terms of how government might be able to repair the damage that it's created, is really to be a bit more inclusive. So you need the oversight and auditing of the OBR, principally, so that people recognize that the fiscal announcements are coming from a place where the numbers have kind of been checked and that there is this holistic approach, but also that people across government and across parties and even within the Conservative Party have been consulted. And then, of course, then opening up that to the impacts of what it means for financial markets and financial stability at large.
Can I build on what Jeff has just said? I mean, I agree that the uncertainty appears to what's spooked the markets. I think what's led to that uncertainty was the fact that these announcements were unexpected. I mean, the expectation was about support for energy, but the other things that went with it were unexpected. They came very soon after the Bank of England had put up interest rates to try and take some, if you like, inflationary pressure and heat out of the economy, whereas tax cutting is usually associated with trying to provide a boost to demand. So potentially it was counterintuitive. Yes, the independent forecast not being there hasn't landed well, even though there was an explanation that this had to be done at pace and the rest would follow later. But two other things in the background that might have contributed to the uncertainty and therefore the market nervousness was the announcements during the leadership campaign about questioning the Bank of England's independence and the recent sort of sacking of the permanent secretary at the Treasury. I think all of those things, I think, have contributed to an atmosphere whereby it was unexpected and uncertain and potentially counterintuitive. And I guess we've seen the responses since the Bank of England have stepped in to support pension funds who are under threat. And we hear today that there's been a meeting between the Prime Minister, the Chancellor and the Office of Budget Responsibility to try and plot the route to the fiscal event on the 23rd of November.
The mini budget was mini in name only. The size and scale of the announcements was staggering, although there was nothing on public service funding. We are now hearing that departments may be asked to find efficiency savings and spending could be frozen at current levels for the next few years. The 2021 spending review is already insufficient, with unexpected pay awards and inflation wiping out the gains. Public bodies do not have the funding to get them back to pre-pandemic performance levels. Is this a case of robbing the public purse to give tax breaks to the wealthiest in society? What will be going through the mind of every local authority leader right now?
Yeah, I think that local authorities have been faced over the last couple of years with rising demand. We've seen some local authorities really suffer with their financial resilience. And the difficulty that this type of activity occurs is because there's no concept of continuity. There's no ability for local authorities to look at their medium-term financial plans and their strategies. And sort of at a very basic level, you know, longer-term strategy is better for value for money, better for decision-making. Where, you know, money is short, that planning horizon shortens. And we see that local authorities are making, you know, short-term decisions, and they're never best decisions. And as that planning horizon reduces, we see weaknesses start to show. And I think that this type of decision making without that long term perspective, which, you know, we have seen in other governments, but it's seemingly to getting worse. Whereas we really do need to make some longer planned decisions and, you know, better outcome based decision making. We seem to be reflecting a much shorter term planning horizon. And from a policy perspective, I think this is a real challenge for policymakers. And we need to move away from it and start to think much, much longer, years and years, not a short term, a year, or even, as it seems to be, month now.
To building on what Joe said, I think council leaders, chief execs, their chief finance officers and their leadership teams will be first and foremost really worried about the impact of all this on their citizens, their residents and on their organisations. It looks like we might not have a spending review that was expected. The last settlement the council's had was portrayed as a relatively generous settlement. Now, there were real terms increases in resources, but that was based on inflation that was running at 2 or 3%. We now have inflation running at 10% or so. And whilst it might come down because of the relief for energy bills, there's going to be rates of inflation affecting both citizens and councils way in excess of what's been provided for, which I think means a return to austerity type measures being required to make savings to balance the books. There might not be austerity in cash terms, but there'll be austerity in terms of real terms cuts in councils' spending power, because the price pressures and the demand pressures running way in excess of what's been provided by inflation. And the government might well point to councils have got more money than they had in the previous year, but that money nowhere meets the demands that are being expected. I think the other thing council leaders will be doing is firstly trying to explain that to the residents, but also be making representations through their MPs and directly to government through their trade associations about the impact of this on citizens and indeed on government policy. So they'll be lobbying about the impact this will have on health and social care, the impact this will have on levelling up, for example.
Just to come back on Andy's point there about health and social care, I think the call for efficiencies will be less than welcome and less than possible, in fact, across the NHS and social care. We did hear in the announcement that the government have committed to maintain the £13 billion, which would have been raised from the health and social care levy, and that they were going to rebalance this funding across the NHS and social care, but not until next year. We all know that social care has badly needed investment to deal with existing pressures for many years, and now with the additional cost of reforms, as well as rising costs. So any rebalancing would be welcome. However, it's unlikely to touch the side of those challenges. The NHS is also seeing pressures, though. The real terms increases they were expecting over the next 3 years have been significantly eroded by inflation, as well as unexpected energy costs and pay deals. They're facing enormous political pressure to reduce backlogs and step up urgent and emergency care. And many systems have already submitted deficit plans this year, and that was prior to the extent that these financial pressures came to light. Both ends of the sector are severely understaffed, and without a fully costed workforce plan, which is not provided for in the spending review settlement, all the other plans and short-term measures are likely to fail. In addition to that, the NHS and social care services are completely interdependent on each other. Therefore, any rebalancing of this money or robbing Peter to pay Paul just shifts the pressures rather than providing a solution.
The last decade of Conservative financial policy has been shredded. Since the budget, we have seen the pound plummet, lenders pull their mortgage deals left, right and centre, and the Bank of England step in to calm markets. What do radical shifts in policy direction mean for businesses and public bodies? Do these shifts have the complete opposite effect of what the government is actually trying to do?
For me, I guess the intended consequence, as you say, is to provide incentives to investment. But I guess the unintended consequence of the uncertainty is businesses and public bodies tend to like certainty because that enables better planning, medium and longer term planning. And when you're uncertain, you have a broader range of things to try and take into account. So I think whilst there might well be an argument about incentives are created, I think the environment that we're now in is of one of financial planning uncertainty. Until we see some of the details of the so-called supply side measures about improving infrastructure investments and maybe planning, until we see the detail there, people are going to have to wait and see. Until we hear about the finance settlement or the settlement for other public bodies, people are going to have to wait and see. And they're probably going to have to plan for the worst and hope for the best. You can't hope for the best and then, if you like, adjust your plans afterwards. That appears to be what the government are doing with its growth strategy. I think sensible, prudent financial management is about planning for the worst, because, you know, and taking that risk-based approach. And if things aren't quite as bad as that, you then have some choice or flexibility. So I think potentially it might have the unintended consequences of stifling the investments that the incentives are designed to create.
From an economic perspective, I think that there is a lot of dissonance in today's policy landscape. Government has really just chopped revenue that government and local government in particular have to spend on vital public services that address the needs of those left behind. And apparently this was the focus of government's leveling up plan. And now it's announced this 2.5% economic growth target. And yet a lot of what it's announced runs contrary to longer term growth prospects. Businesses are confused. First, it was an industrial strategy plan that the UK had. Then it was leveling up and a plan for growth that the previous administration was quite vocal about. And now it's all of that seems to have gone to the wayside. And that's very confusing for businesses. As Andy says, who would want to invest domestically in the UK if policy, major substantial policy pillars just change on the fly? It's very nerve-wracking for businesses. And I think we've seen this in the recent convulsion of financial markets. You've seen the pound plummet to near parity with the US dollar. And this will have severe impacts on the cost of living crisis that the government is trying to address. Inflation will go higher as imports become costlier with the weaker pound, and businesses just don't have that confidence in what's happening domestically. And there's always this relative perspective that we need to keep in mind, whether we're in the UK or elsewhere, which is that whilst the global economy is still recovering from the pandemic and everyone's suffering from the higher food, energy costs, there is greater stability in economic policy elsewhere, whether that's in Europe or the US. Everyone has a bit of their own different types of problems. But why, if you're a multinational, what is it specific that would attract you to investing in the UK versus these other advanced economies? Currently, there isn't that much of an appeal. And just saying that we're keeping corporate tax rates at 19% isn't going to be enough, because you know what? At 19%, we still were having one of the lowest rates of business investment across the G7. So that isn't a solution. And I think we are in a pickle today, and government really needs to be much clearer as to how it's going to maintain the policy landscape so that businesses can actually invest for tomorrow.
There was a really good piece of work from the Institute of Government about policy making recently. And I think a lot of it is also about accountability. You know, policies are changing so quick that, you know, there isn't that strength of accountability and sort of challenge or expertise in the policy making arena. If that was strengthened, we would have better policies being brought in.
I think there's also a link there to make that possibly has been missed between the desire for economic growth and the potential spending restraint on the public sector, because in lots of areas, public sector organisations can act as anchor institutions for the local economy. So, for example, in some areas, the NHS or local government are the major employers. And if they're being asked to effectively return to the days of austerity, then that's investment that's missing from those local economies and potentially impacting on employment levels as well. So it's not just private sector investment that we need to be thinking about.
The government are planning to borrow significantly more to pay for the tax cuts. But of course, the more we borrow now, the more debt that the next generation will be burdened with tomorrow. How is that fair? All the tax cuts announced would benefit older people the most, especially those on high incomes. Is it always the young that get the short straw?
I think what you've got to remember, going back to Liz Truss, though they, you know, members of the Conservative Party would have voted her in, and Independent did a really interesting piece on, you know, who they voting her in. 65% are male, only 37% female, of which 6% of that group would have been under 24, and over 39% of that is over 65. And demographically, you know, mainly in the southeast, and of a certainly socioeconomic group. So they have elected the prime minister who is now putting into these. So I think that you're quite right. Jeff made the very good comment about SDGs and longer term. And I spoke earlier about the longer term vision. It's not long term. It's very, very short term, those horizons. We are failing the younger generation, leaving them with the climate change issues, still sort of social care issues, borrowing, and it needs that focus, needs to change.
And I would completely agree with you from the perspective of the public services themselves. I mean, looking at the wider view around health and social care, just before the growth plan, we saw the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care's plan for patients to get us through the winter, which understandably took a short-term focus. But to date, the new government have made no mention of their wider intentions for the policy reforms that were going on in health and social care, except for a suggestion last night that the white paper on health inequalities may now not appear. I think this raises concerns around the potential erosion of the policy direction. Previously, we were looking at a focus on the wider determinants of health, reducing inequalities, putting more emphasis on preventative approaches, and overall improving the population health and well-being, and in doing so, trying to reduce demand for public services in the future. To do that, you need to have clarity on what your priorities are. You need to have sufficient funding for your services, and you need to have certainty of that funding into the long term, none of which appears to be forthcoming. And I think if we don't start to take a twin track approach to deal with both the short term pressures and these longer term priorities across health and care, then all we're doing is guarantee that we continue to need to fight those fires in the future rather than ensuring that those services are sustainable for future generations.
I think as a society, we need to ask ourselves the role that public services play in our lives. And if we want more public services, whether you're old or young, there needs to be mechanisms in place where we can pay for those services. And so if as a society we're saying we don't want to pay more taxes or we want to have tax cuts, then we need to recognize what that means in terms of the scope and quality of the services that we benefit from. In terms of younger people, I think they can play a big role in how the policy landscape evolves. More young people need to go out and vote. More people need to participate in civil society. They need to volunteer more. They need to run for public office. They need to hold their leaders to account. And equally, I think we need to see more young people entering the profession of public financial management and asking how can we improve the sector so that there is more transparency and accountability. And so there, I don't think the young cohort always gets the short straw. I think we need to challenge younger people to step forward, be more vocal. And it's only through that way that they will get a bigger piece of the pie, so to speak.
Just on the intergenerational equity point, I think whilst that's been brought into focus by this question about tax cuts and the beneficiaries being older people on higher incomes, it goes back a long time, this issue, even pre-COVID. And young people, even during the COVID investments the government had to make, probably understood that the government had to borrow to fund the COVID protections over a long period of time. But if I just go back, say, 20 years or so, in that time, pensioners have gone from being pretty impoverished to now being protected by the so-called triple lock, which means that pensions are rising by the higher of inflation or average earnings. And the intention there, of course, is to give pensions the ability to protect their real incomes as they go into retirement, having contributed economically for most of their working lives. And then students have started to pay towards the cost of their tuition through student loans or graduate tax on the basis that the higher salary you'll get from going to through higher education or university ultimately will, you know, you'll get the benefit from that. But actually, I don't think the intended consequences of both those two things would be to young people from the housing market, for example, in the way that's happened for a lot of, for some different reasons. So I think there are big societal questions about intergenerational equity and what is fair across generations that predate this last announcement. And I think the can we afford pensions triple lock and is it fair students pay as much as they do towards the cost of their education? We are different to many international countries in those two approaches.
That concludes this edition of Sit for Speaks. You can find our previous episodes on Sitfa's website or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow us on social media for more and to make sure that you never miss another episode of the podcast. We'll be back next month with more information that public finance professionals need to know about. Until then, thank you for listening and goodbye.